Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by San Jose State University Doctoral Program in Educational Leadership, a new professional degree program offered for leaders in education. Accepting applications at sjsu.edu/edd.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Why do the American children who have won the International Tchaikovsky Music Competition in the past two decades all have Chinese surnames? Why do Indian American children seem to win spelling bees with such frequency? Authors Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld think they have the answer. They call it the triple package, a combination of qualities that some cultures encourage and others do not. Does culture explain success? What about the role of history, class, wealth, and prejudice? Chua and Rubenfeld take it all on, as will we, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld are Yale Law School professors who aren't afraid to say what they think. Chua ignited a firestorm with her previous book, The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. Now the husband and wife team have co-authored an equally provocative new book that attempts to explain why some groups in America are more successful than others. America's most successful groups, they write, tend to be cultural outsiders, groups who resist today's dominant American culture. They argue that groups like Chinese Americans, Nigerian Americans, Mormons, among others, all flourish because they possess a combination of qualities they call the triple package, qualities that allow some groups to outshine others. It's a premise that has put Chua and Rubenfeld in a familiar spot, generating both kudos and controversy. The book is called The Triple Package: How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America. And Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld join us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Pleasure to have you both here. So let's define, for starters, the triple package, which is this combination of both feelings of superiority, insecurity or inferiority, and impulse control. It seems like an unlikely combination. So let's walk through them. Why is superiority in part of this?
Well, first, any one of these qualities by themselves won't do it. You know, if you feel superior, you're probably just going to be complacent. I'm superior, sit back on my laurels. It's really the sense of exceptionality, which can come from lots of different sources, you know, belonging to a certain group or a family or even just a parent that instills that sense that you're special. But it's only in combination with a dash of the second element, insecurity, that we say you actually kind of generates this need to prove yourself, this you know, goading, I'm not respected enough, I need to show everybody. And the third element is impulse control, which is kind of what gives you the ability to realize, you know, that drive.
Give me an example from each of your childhoods, if you would, of how that played out for each of you. How did insecurity and superiority combine in your own growing up as a Chinese American or as a Jewish American? How did those play out?
Well, for me, the whole, you know, in a way, the book is about how, at a personal level, about how to turn being into an outsider, a minority, into a source of strength. So, to give you a good example, I went to school at El Cerrito High School, but when I was a kid here, you know, fourth grade, I remember there was this guy who just kept teasing me. He made slanty eyes. I used to have a Chinese accent. He would just like poke fun at me all the time. And I went home and told my mother about this. And my mother said, why do you care what that person thinks? We come, you know, if he's going to be so stupid to make fun of you, the slanty eyes, we come from such the most ancient civilization, the greatest civilization. And, you know, why would you even care what this person thinks? So that, you know, has its own negative connotations. That's why we chose this term, ambivalent term, superiority complex, because it shades into ethnocentrism. But for me as a kid, that sense of ethnic pride and heritage was like a shield against majority prejudice in some ways.
But you're also saying at the same time, it was useful to have a mother who probably said at one point, why did you just get an A? Why wasn't it an A plus?
Exactly. And so there's the level of being insecure vis-a-vis society. But at the same time, it's, believe it or not, a sense of insecurity created by your parents. You know, this is statistical. There's studies showing this, that Asian and South Asian parents tend to impose exorbitantly high academic expectations. So you get the 99 instead of praise. Yeah, why isn't it 100? To make it worse even, studies also show that many Asian parents frequently make comparisons to other people's successful kids. You know, hey, so-and-so's son just became valedictorian and your cousin just got into Harvard. And that also makes you feel not good enough. And so that's part of the drive.
And Jed Rubenfeld, add in this third element, which in some ways I find the most fascinating, which is what you refer to as impulse control. But as I understand what you're writing, it's really about discipline and drive. So how does that ingredient tie into these other two?
Well, I think I might be able to best illustrate it by telling you about the single most important social science experiment ever conducted. I'll bet some of your listeners have heard of it. It's called the marshmallow test. And so they put 3, 4, 5-year-old kids at a table and handed them a marshmallow. And they said, look, you can either eat this marshmallow right up, or if you wait 15 minutes, you'll get a second one. Well, most of the kids ate the marshmallow. About a third of them didn't. They waited the 15 minutes and got the second marshmallow. Then the researchers, almost by accident, tracked these kids 20 years later. And to everyone's surprise, the kids who had waited the 15 minutes were doing remarkably better on every metric they looked at, that is, educationally, occupationally, stronger families, making more money. It was more predictive of achievement in these ways than IQ was, staying out of jail, less substance abuse. And this finding has been replicated all over the world. So that's an example of impulse control. And in combination with these other qualities that Amy is describing, it's like an engine of deferred gratification. And it turns out that some groups in America are more frequently instilling and strengthening that quality in their members, in their kids. And there's plenty of studies that show this quality of impulse control can be strengthened. And, you know, our feeling was, look, let's have the courage to look at this in the face. There is this remarkable fact out there that there are these groups. And by the way, it's not just the 8 that we focus on. There are literally dozens of groups outperforming the national average. But let's have the courage to look at it, pull the curtain back, see if we can figure out how it's happening, because maybe we can all learn from it.
So if you take these factors then and combine them, as you have in your premise, that a sense of superiority and pride, a sense of, yeah, but you still better get pushed towards getting 100 and not just the 99, and a sense of, I'm going to resist the temptation to indulge in what's easy. I'm going to resist the temptation to quit. I'm going to hang in there and drive forward to success. Now apply the cultural part of this, because this is where, as you suggest, it becomes a more difficult conversation to have. And I want to have you describe what you were telling me right before we went on the air about why you first started writing this book, what you noticed at Yale University, where you're both law professors. What made you start thinking about this particular book?
Yes, well, we are both teachers, so we have a lot of students. And about 5 years ago, we started noticing some things that struck us as unusual. Suddenly, it seemed that there were more Mormons in our classes than we used to have. There seemed to be a few more Cuban Americans than one might have expected. Asian American numbers were on the rise. And we said to ourselves, well, it's probably just Yale or too small a sample size. You know, you can't draw any conclusions. So at a certain point, we said, well, wait, maybe we should dig into the data. Maybe there's something going on here. And we looked very systematically, very rigorously at all the economic and educational data we could find. And sure enough, this pattern is happening all over the country. But I can't stress enough that the qualities that we found that these groups share, propelling their success, are available to anyone. In any given family, a parent, a strong grandparent, a teacher can instill these qualities. And plenty of individuals not from these groups have these qualities. Our president is a very good example.
Let's look at one example that you talk about in your book, and that's the success of Nigerian Americans. And you point out that they are less than 1% of the black population in this country, but represent 10 times more than that in the number of students that populate elite universities. And that in some studies that have been done at Princeton and elsewhere indicate that a large number, approaching 40% perhaps, of black student population at elite universities have an immigrant as a parent. What do you make of that? And then I want to know how you necessarily determine that the cause of that is the triple package.
Great. So we focus on Nigerians because they're actually the largest immigrant group from Africa. But I want to say also, echoing Jed, that, you know, this is a larger phenomenon. We have Jamaican Americans, Ghanaian, Kenyan Americans, also starkly disproportionately represented. So the what's interesting is that it's not some sort of essentialist culture. That's not how we're talking about it. The Nigerians who come over are, the vast majority of them in the United States, come from the Igbo or Yoruba groups. And these are groups with proud lineage back in their home countries. Many of them have high status, not necessarily wealthy, but they come into this country. So that's the sense of exceptionalism. You know, they come to this country and they run straight smack into American racism. I can't tell you how many of my students say, stop and frisk, you know, discriminated against, denials of opportunity. Now, that can be a very negative thing. But sometimes in these cases, what happens is that feeling of simultaneously feeling, you know, great sense of pride and then suddenly being looked down on and mistreated can create this feeling of like, well, I am going to show everybody. That can create drive and almost a resentment that makes people have a chip on their shoulder and say, I'm going to work 20 times as hard as anybody else and we will show everybody, you know. And by the way, this book has been so misunderstood. This is not just a celebration of the triple package and success. I mean, there are many negatives. That feeling of I need to show everybody, I need to prove myself, I'm not good enough, it can be a very painful feeling, and that's half the book. But also, this kind of pressure tends to force people into conventional forms of success, because if you want to show everybody, you want to prove to your parents so they can tell their friends. It's often going to be a doctor, be a lawyer, not necessarily what you want to be.
I want to get to that as you write in the book, the underside of the triple package in a bit. But I want to stay with this question because it seems to me really crucial to your premise about what it is, about whether that's Nigerian Americans, Indian Americans who come to this country and do very well economically, Cuban Americans and so forth. Because you could make the argument, you could push back that what that's really about is not some triple package that's bubbling around inside you. It's that these are people who have come to this country with a certain advantage from the get-go. Cuban Americans who came to this country in the 50s and 60s were from a higher class and had more advantages in Cuba. Indian Americans who came to this country were beneficiaries of certain visa policies that made them people who came here were of a higher status. Similarly with Nigerian Americans. So can't you make the argument, Jed Rubenfeld, that this is really about isn't some mysterious triple package thing. It's really about people who come here with advantages from the get-go.
Yes, in a way, the most comforting explanation would be that it's just an immigrant selectivity phenomenon of the kind you're describing. And those factors are important. They're just not nearly as important as people think they are. And you just have to look at the data for this because it's just perhaps an uncomfortable truth. But you can find that the actual facts don't support the explanation you were giving. We might have the stereotype that the Indian American immigrant is the high-tech engineer and that the Chinese American immigrant is coming over on the education visa. The fact is just under half of Indian immigrants and over half of Chinese immigrants do not come over on those special visa qualifications. More than that, these populations have been studied, and the finding, which has now been replicated in Los Angeles, New York, Toronto, and the UK, is that the children of these Asian American immigrants are achieving the best grades and best scores at school. I'm talking about the children of these immigrants, and they're doing so irrespective of their parents' socioeconomic status. So the data shows, and this has conclusively been shown, that even the kids of the poor and poorly educated restaurant workers and dry cleaners are outperforming their more privileged, better educated white peers. Now, that's the fascinating phenomenon that we just have to look at and be willing to address and ask why. And I have to add one more thing about this, because in case somebody out there thinks that this is genetic, here's one of the most interesting things that we found in our research. When the researchers dug into the data even more, they found that third generation Asian American kids, as we were saying, as we say in our book, and there is no difference between their academic performance and that of the rest of the country. And this proves it is not genetic. This proves it is not biological. This disproves the whole model minority stereotype.
It would also suggest that this comes from the drive to some extent of the immigrant experience, whether that would be the Irish a century and a half ago or these groups now, that it's an effect in a way that people come to this country with an intensity that perhaps dissipates over time?
Well, now that is exactly the thesis of our book. Sociologists have known for 100 years that these waves of immigrants come in, the Italian Americans, the Irish Americans, before them, the Protestants who settled this country and built this country, their kids, the next generation, has this charge, this drive. And our book is a book about asking how that happens. Can we explain that? Can we find the formula? Because if we could figure out what's putting the charge and the drive and the abilities into those kids, wouldn't that be interesting? Couldn't we all learn from that?
Let me push back at you at one thing, though, about the Cuban-American experience in particular, because as you acknowledge in the book and has also been reported by others, that first wave of Cuban immigrants they didn't arrive necessarily with lots of money, but they arrived with certain advantages and with certain class benefits, very different from the wave of Cuban immigrants that came over in the 80s. Now, are you telling me that the children of those early Miami immigrants and the children of the wave of immigrants that came over in the 80s, that those children who came over in the 80s are doing just as well?
No, actually, let me just clarify. So the Cuban immigrants, you're absolutely right, and maybe this will be helpful. I do want to stress, though, that people mischaracterize that. So the Cuban exiles that came over after Castro, a large portion of them, but actually not as many as people think, they were professionals back home. But remember, when they arrived in this country, they had $5 because they were confiscated. And it is not the case that they stepped into Miami and became doctors. You know, they had to work as vegetable pickers. They had to work as janitors and maids. They saw signs that said no dogs and Cubans allowed. They slept 12 to a room. So,
but they might have been doctors and successful businessmen in Miami before.
Absolutely.
And that's a real difference between who came over in the 80s versus who came over in the 50s and 60s.
Exactly. And that's part of our thesis. The Iranian Americans, too. We talk about the status collapse. You know, and that's part of this idea. You feel exceptional and now you're suddenly looked down on, and that gives the charge. But our book is about trying to capture what they taught their children. Okay, so their children are now born in this country and they're growing up poor. And their parents may exactly have these advantages, but they are certainly poor economically. So our thesis is not – it's not saying that we replace all those other ideas. Of course that's partly true. You know, that's kind of what we're looking at. But that – the question of what are they instilling, what behaviors are these types of people instilling in their children that tend to generate more academic success and great career trajectories. Now, we're not saying that everybody needs to follow that, but if we can kind of isolate that, you know, maybe other people can take those behaviors too.
Well, let's drill down on that further, and we'll come back, I'm sure, to the question of race and culture throughout the hour this morning. But one of the things you make the point of saying is that this ethos that you're describing, this combination of drive, superiority with a twinge of insecurity and inferiority stands quite apart from the sort of norm in America today. Make that point, if you would. What do you see going on that you think is so valuable that is, in a sense, not contemporary America?
Well, it's so interesting. You know, we think that the values of the triple package are traditional American values. Historically, you find in America for hundreds of years this sense of exceptionality combined with an insecurity. The country's borders weren't safe in its early origins, and the country always had this chip on its shoulder vis-a-vis more aristocratic Europe. We were going to prove that equality and democracy was just as good as, better than the political systems of the old world. Plus, a long tradition inherited from the Puritans of impulse control, hard work, and discipline of that sort. Now, I do think that in recent decades, America has interesting things have happened in the culture which have moved us to some degree away from those things. We have more of an emphasis on self-esteem building in our kids, which is not the same as the kind of insecurity that we've been describing. And the studies, by the way, show that building self-esteem in kids when it's not earned, when it's just pure praise, how special you are, does not help them succeed academically or occupationally.
You're talking about the sort of everyone gets a trophy kind
of philosophy. Exactly. And for, 30 years, educators in America, lots of them really had the view that what you had to do was instill self-esteem in kids and everything good would follow from that. Well, it was a nice thought, but sadly, the facts, the data disprove it. That is, they've done controlled experiments now, believe it or not, where they give one set of kids self-esteem boosting messages and another set of kids in the same class, they don't get that message. And it turns out if you give kids the self-esteem boosting message, they do worse on their study habits and on their exams later.
So do you believe then that it's really important for a parent to make their child feel insecure?
Well, it's so interesting. I think our book really covers this in a subtle and open way. I mean, what parent wants to tell their child, you're not good enough? The children who are raised with that message can feel a pain that lasts their whole lifetime. Our thought is there's got to be a way to titrate this, to give it the right dose. I mean, can you communicate to the kids? And every single one of these cultures that we studied does this. They communicate to the sense, you got to make it. You might be in trouble in this country. You've got to survive, to make it, to overcome discrimination. You've got to work much harder. Or to satisfy us, your parents, you're not good enough yet. You've got to make it. Now, is there a way to communicate that message while also communicating unconditional love and a support for them? We think there is.
What do you think about that, Amy Cho? Because you wrote about this, in your book, which first book, your Tiger Mom book, and you tell the Amy Tan story.
Yeah.
About it's hard to really get a sense that that's healthy.
Right. Amy Tan is amazing, describing this feeling that she said, I felt I could never, ever, ever please my mother. And it was a horrible feeling. And at one point, I just wanted to die. Right. Now, that's an extreme case because I was raised by very strict parents. And for me, it was very empowering. So here's something interesting. This need to prove yourself, that I'm not quite good enough yet, is the polar opposite of being entitled. And I think both extremes are bad. I think on the one hand, I'm entitled means I don't need to prove myself. I'm entitled to be a CEO. I'm entitled to go to this college. I'm entitled to have everybody like me. That can't be good. And then the other extreme, I'm never good enough, is pretty bad too. So is there, in a way, the book is about, can we learn from this? I do think that in American popular culture now, we've moved a little bit too far in one direction. And in some ways, I think some members of these cultures we're looking at, we spoke to an amazingly interesting Mormon young woman who was extremely successful, but she said, the pressures that I felt, just never quite, I need to strive more, not good enough, is not something I would want to do with my own children. And we lay it all out there, but the idea that this should be taboo is what's so odd, right?
What should be taboo? You mean having this conversation?
Having this conversation that at any group, point in time, certain behaviors produce, disproportionate academic success with costs, right? It's not all good. Let's talk about this as opposed to, no, you're stereotyping. You can't say that. I mean, that's been interesting.
Amy Chua and Judd Rubenfeld are our guests this hour. They'll be at the Commonwealth Club, by the way, this afternoon at noon to talk about their book, and also at Book Passage in Corte Madera tomorrow afternoon. They will be there at 4 o'clock at Book Passage in Corte Madera. We'd welcome your participation in this fascinating, provocative topic. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Post your thoughts on our Facebook page or our website as well, and we will get to all of them when we return. We have Molly, Anthony, Stan, and Annalise lined up, ready to join our conversation. Comments from Alice, Rona, David, and others ready to join in as well. We'll talk more with Judd Rubenfeld and Amy Chua about the triple package, how three unlikely traits explain the rise and fall of cultural groups in America. More in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guests this hour, Jed Rubenfeld and Amy Chua, the authors of a new book called The Triple Package, How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America. They'll be at the Commonwealth Club today at noon, tomorrow at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 4 o'clock. We welcome your participation, comments, questions, your own immigrant experience, if that is relevant to what you would like to observe. We'd welcome that perspective in particular. 866-733-6786 is our number. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Let's start with Kelly in San Francisco. Kelly, go ahead.
Hi. I was just calling to say that, you know, my interest definitely has been piqued to check out their book. I'm Korean American. I grew up here. I wasn't born here, but, you know, my family immigrated when I was around 3 years old. And everything that she's talking about is true. You know, the pressures from, you know, the typical, quote-unquote, Asian parent that, you know, wants you to succeed over everybody else. And, it, you know, it struck a chord with me when she said that a lot of parents compare, you know, you to other children or other parents' children and say, well, you know, this kid got straight A's and you got one A minus. You know, why did you do that? It's, you know, it's absolutely true to the point where, you know, I laugh at different, you know, Facebook memes that have been created, you know, how you grew up with immigrant parents. And, you know, I kind of take it humorously, but I think that it is, in this case, or in my case especially, the triple package, you know, tends to apply because we did all kind of face racism. You know, I got the whole slanty-eyed, people assuming I was Chinese, even though, you know, I'm technically not, just because I look Asian, you know, all those things. It was a driving factor for me, but I think, you know, me personally, I was just a little bit more rebellious, so I didn't end up a doctor or a lawyer, but I think that the point that they're making is pretty fascinating. And
Kelly, if I could interject for a moment, is it on balance an experience that you feel was good for you, and is it one you would replicate as a parent?
You know, I'm 50-50 on it because at the time, if I think about it now, you know, I'm almost 30 now, and when I was a kid, it didn't feel good, and I think that it made my probably pre-existing rebellious, you know, state a little bit more in that, you know, I kind of wanted to do the opposite because I was so irritated at that, you know, why is my mom comparing me to all these other kids when she's not seeing my good, you know, my good features? I felt kind of maybe overlooked in that sense, that nothing I could ever do was good enough, until later on, I think my parents and I both grew up, you know, in a sense where they figured out that, okay, I don't need to be this boxed in typical Asian kid that excels at math and plays piano and violin and, you know, concert style, and it's, you know, it was still okay to be me. So I think I wouldn't probably do the same things that my parents did when I was growing up in all the comparisons, because I don't think that that's a positive influence on every child. I think every child could grow up differently. I just happened to not let it affect me in a negative way, and I kind of took the positive of it.
Thank you, Kelly. Thanks for getting us started in this part of our conversation. Let's talk a little bit more about this, about what you refer to as the underside of growing up like this, and that Kelly touched on to a degree. And you use the phrase, Jed, of sort of titrating it. Is that sort of the way in which you should take this in sort of small doses?
Well, we did not write this book as a how-to, and it's interesting that everybody wants to see it that way. The first page of our book, we say this is actually an honest view of what it means to be driven and successful in including its psychological spurs and pains and costs. That's almost, you know, just what Kelly was talking about. She mentioned rebellion, and I'm so glad she mentioned that, because that's a huge part of this book. This is not a celebration of the triple package, right? It's really about how these immigrant groups do this, and then that kind of almost like clashes with American individualism and rebelliousness in a way that I think is what's good about America. So all three elements of the triple package, the superiority complex, that's very, you know, present usually in the immigrant group, because they come over, I'm proudly Italian, I'm proudly whatever, Greek. The second generation, their kids, you know, thank goodness they're imbued with the American norm of equality. They're a little uncomfortable. They want to intermarry. They're like, what's the deal? And so that erodes. That's a good thing. Maybe insecurity gets less, good or bad. I don't know. Maybe a little bit more smug. But this idea of, like, you know, Kelly was saying, the first generation, you have to do something that can help you survive. You have to be a doctor. The next generation will rebel. I don't want to be what you want me to be. And so when I say titrate, I don't mean exactly a little piece of it. It's more like it's going to be different for every individual and every family. But that friction may not be a bad thing. Take a little bit of that drive and grit, but inject some rebelliousness in it. And, you know, it's America.
I want to come back to I want to ask you to try to persuade me of something, I guess. And that is, I find your thesis very provocative, but I'm not convinced. And that's because I'm not sure that there's the evidence. In other words, there are other explanations for this. We talked about, you know, whether or not you have the right visa, what your history was in your homeland, that there's the factor of history and race and class. And there, it seems to me that there are many other explanations for this possibly, as opposed to something that, you know, you referred to Justice Sotomayor at one point as a triple package child. How do you know that? How do you know that that's what's going on, as opposed to the fact that any number of other factors made her who she is today?
Well, there are so many factors that do go into it. We're just offering an explanation of part of the story. And, you know, the idea that you couldn't say, for example, that Asian American kids' study habits are part of what's causing their educational success. I mean, come on. That's common sense. And the idea, oh, we better not say that because that's going to create sensitivity. That's cultural racism. That overlooks other causes. You know, it's just – that's just tying your hands behind your back and not offering to people, you know, something that everybody can learn from. But let me be very clear about this. If you look at America's disadvantaged groups, historically low-income groups, what are the causes of that? Everybody knows what the causes of that poverty are. A history of discrimination, in one case, slavery for centuries, structural exclusions, macroeconomic changes, the disappearance of manufacturing jobs that have nothing to do with culture and denials of opportunity of all kinds. Now, all of that is true. And what does that mean? That means America has to change. We need more jobs. We need to try to level the playing field. We need to try to get rid of discrimination. We need to try to institutionally and socially change in all of these ways. Yes, of course. Now, does that mean that there is nothing individuals can do in their own lives, that they just have to wait for these gigantic social changes, maybe wait 100 years? Is that a message that we can really live with? Is that a message of hope and respect, that there is nothing individuals can do in their own lives to change their lives? I don't think that's empowering. So, you know, that's what we're writing about.
Annalise in San Francisco has our next call. Annalise, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Annalise Hines, and I'm a PhD candidate in history at Stanford University. And part of what I look at is Asian American history. And so I have a number of questions and concerns for your guests, and some of them relate to what you all just spoke to. But my questions are about the kind of structural issues and changes in American society that shape individuals and group, quote, success. One of my concerns is that I feel like the guests are painting Asian immigrant groups with a very broad brush, and I hear Asian American activists, contemporary Asian American activists, trying to raise awareness of the diversity of experiences and the ways in which structural issues very deeply shape individual experiences that may actually share some of these same underlying cultural patterns, the differences between children of wealthier or more educated Hong Kong immigrants versus Hmong refugees in Laos are the kind of two most common examples I hear. But I think that that relates to the importance of these structural issues of class and race and how those have actually changed to shape opportunity. And I think that the historical perspective then is really important in
yeah.
this conversation.
Let me hold you there, Annalise. It's a very useful question, both in terms of making the differentiation between different kinds of Asian American groups and the role of class in history. Amy Chua.
Yeah, actually, I just totally agree with you. You know, if you read our book, you see how careful we are distinguishing all the different Asian American groups. We talk about the Hmong, the Cambodians, the Vietnamese. So that's all I'll say about that. We agree with you very much. But I also want to shift and partly answer your question, you know, how do you know? We are not only talking about immigrants. We arrived at our hypothesis by looking at a group, all these groups, including Mormons. Okay, Mormons are not immigrants. You can't make a selection argument there. And Jews are no longer immediate immigrants. And so we said, what do all these groups have in common? And I think it's fascinating, for example, that the Mormons have a very strong sense of exceptionality, this chosen people narrative, a more moral person, but also this drive, and this is in their own explanations, not quite accepted by mainstream America, a cult, you know, not quite Christian. And by their own accounts, it's like that makes chip on the shoulder. That gives me this feeling we're going to, you know, really need to show ourselves. And so I think that it's of course, you know, in some ways, here's a great example. We have had a lot of criticism, but just an incredibly nice group of people emailing us are teachers, educators. And, you know, I got an email from somebody who was a Latino, Southern California, said, I teach public high school. And I'm also a father. And I think about culture and success all the time. I see with my own eyes that these Asian kids have different study patterns. And I mean certain kinds of Asians, right? I mean, I don't mean all, but generally. And that leads to better academic results. So I said to my son, I want you to copy that. I want you to do these things. We're going to do that. And now my son is a straight A student. And that's kind of all we mean, right? It's not some Confucian thing that's attached to a group. It's a behavior that, you know, that people can adopt.
Annalise, thanks for the call. Let me read a few Facebook comments coming in, and then we'll get back to our conversation. A listener writes, immigrant families come to this country with an idealistic view of it, and they come here because they want to join the mainstream narrative of success. However, people who have lived here for many generations and who have seen this culture up close know the unspoken ambiguities and built-in inequities, and the long history of knowing and experiencing this ugly side might have a harder time and take longer to get over American baggage and desire to join the mainstream. I recently heard an interview with Ms. Chua and Mr. Rubenfeld on another NPR show. I applaud them for having the courage to investigate and publish their observations. Divya writes, I'm an immigrant from India. I think the reason I push my child harder than non-immigrants is because I've seen how bad things can be for people who do not focus on education. That difference is not as visible in American society as it is in countries with rampant poverty, and that's a good thing. Alice asks, what is the role of class in groups that tend to have the triple package? Wouldn't that impact the degree of success? You want to take that one up, Jed Rubenfeld, the question of class?
Everybody in America knows today that class has a tremendous effect on the chances of success of the next generation. So there's no doubt that class privilege, handing down the privileges and advantages of wealth to the kids, is an important factor in America today. It's just a fact, however, that in these immigrant communities, you are finding the kids of poor and poorly educated parents experiencing rates of exceptional upward mobility that are higher than more privileged, better educated white Americans. And you see, that's the comparison we're making. We're not comparing one immigrant group to another immigrant group and trying to say this, their culture, is the explanation of why they have statistically higher income than another immigrant group, as if that was the comparison. We're saying they're doing better than better educated and more privileged whites. And why can't we look at that phenomenon and try to learn from it? And let me just give you one more example, if I could. Jewish Americans. Millions of them came between 1900 and 1920. This was the wave of immigrants from Eastern Europe and Russia. My grandfather was among them. He was a butcher. And many, many hundreds of thousands of these Jewish immigrants did not have what the now, you know, the stereotype now is of this long education culture and scholarliness. No, they were very poorly educated. And yet the next generation rose and outperformed the more dominant WASP elite. And that's the striking phenomenon.
You know, my question isn't so much to dispute that phenomenon or, as you suggest, the impact that Asian American kids spending five times as much time on focused study habits as their Anglo counterparts said that wouldn't have effect. Of course it would. I guess I'm just curious about the science of this, because do we really know this? In other words, has there been a definitive study of these elements that would make this more causation as opposed to just association?
Well, in fact, there are many studies that support every premise of our theory. I can very briefly tell you that I've mentioned the marshmallow test. And the link between impulse control and success has now been demonstrated. There are studies that show that believing that you are a member of a group that's good at something actually lifts your performance when you're tested on that thing. That's called stereotype boost. But, you know, more generally than that, sociology is not a science. It is, at its best, a data-driven interpretive discipline. Now, we've put forward a hypothesis. Have we done the randomized study of 100,000 people where you code for these qualities and test? We have not done that. We welcome it. We've put forward a hypothesis. Mm. If this could be tested, and I believe it can be tested, that would be tremendous.
That would be tremendous. That would be incredibly fascinating. Michelle in San Jose wants to join our conversation. Michelle, go ahead, please.
Thank you. just my personal experience, the education for the children, it came from family first, and second will be school, and the third one will be society. That's mean the environment they live. Doesn't matter they are poor or rich, or doesn't matter they are immune or they are native. So the main thing is the parent is wholly responsible for their children. They have to teach their children the value, what is good and what is bad, and learn from there and hard work.
And Michelle, may I ask where you're from originally, please?
I am a Vietnamese.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for adding in your perspective. It's helpful to hear. On the question of parenting, and as Michelle suggests, that's so central to this. And you bring up the sort of dirty word of self-esteem to the degree that you think that that's something that can be granted too readily. Here's my question. It seems to me that one important thing for any parent to do is to give to your child the gift of believing in them. That doesn't mean that you pat them on the back for everything they do. That doesn't mean you give them a trophy every time they step out the door. But believing in them, believing that they have great talent and great worth, it seems to me is so central to what being a parent is.
But that is so consistent with our thesis. It practically is our thesis. That's leg one, that sense of exceptionality. My parents definitely gave me that. You know what's interesting is in the concept of high expectations, this is how we analytically see high expectations. It's a blend of superiority and insecurity. On the one hand, it's why when you say you have high expectations that you can be a, you know, it's you can be the best. We believe in you. We know you can be amazing. And then the expectation part is, but you haven't done it yet. And I completely think it is possible to have high expectations and be implanting in your kids this idea that you, we believe in you unequivocally.
Molly in San Francisco is next. Molly, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm a high school teacher in Redwood City. So, you know, I see a lot of what you're saying reflected in my students. I'm particularly interested in this issue of superiority versus insecurity because I have students, of course, come from immigrant families who don't come with a sense of superiority because they've been exposed a lot to U.S. media and, of course, in the United States, their groups aren't seen, aren't presented in the media in positive ways. So I'm wondering about you have insecurity in the face of superiority is a good combination. But when you have a feeling of insecurity because society has given you a low status treatment, plus any kind of insecurity, you know, that you might have in terms of the pressure to succeed, I just think that we really need, like in California with the minority-majority issue, it's really time to reverse the image of so many groups in California who don't, you know, who have to really deal with the history of discrimination because it's going to help them succeed in the schools.
Great point, Molly. And you, in fact, talk about this some in the book that you make the point that it's almost impossible for some minority groups, African Americans in particular, to come by the what you call the triple package because of the very things that Molly is describing.
It's such a great point. And a long history of discrimination and denigration, a conscious effort by the country to impose a second-class status or a badge of inferiority in a group, that's one of the things we're writing about. One of the pernicious legacies of that history is the deprivation from within a culture or a group of being able to have the same kinds of exceptionality or superiority narratives that other groups are taking advantage of.
But it's not impossible. I want to stress that we don't say it's impossible because within, for example, we explore in our book, you know, we don't have the answers, but we dare to talk about some of the studies about historically black colleges and universities. It's very interesting. You'd be amazed how many very prominent African-American leaders came from those schools. And that the Black Power movement in the 60s was precisely an attempt to try to deal with this idea. Can we make a superiority complex?
Let me just interject on that point because I've just got a Facebook comment on precisely this. Waladin writes, can you ask Amy Chua to account for Black Americans who were not immigrants but who fought for civil rights? They had the triple package. There are core groups of Blacks that have that but are thwarted by systematic racism, discrimination, and bad public policy. How do you account for that. But I think she's making the point that those very leaders you were just describing did have all of the elements that you're putting forward.
Oh, absolutely. I could not agree with that more. I mean, we spend so much time in our book talking about, look, if you do not have the institutions, if you do not have a level playing field, if the society will not reward you when you work hard, it doesn't matter if you have any of these triple package qualities, right? You need – Here's, I think, the most interesting study in our book. Jed mentioned the marshmallow test. Well, I'll call this the reverse marshmallow test. Just recently at the University of Rochester, they ran this test again, but they did one twist. With half the kids, they lied to them first. They said, look, if you do this, we'll give you these cool art supplies. And then they broke their promise. And then they did the marshmallow test. You want to take the marshmallow now or wait 15 minutes? All of the kids who had been lied to grabbed the first marshmallow. Hmm. And that makes sense. The point is, if your institutions let you down, if they don't reward hard work, if you don't believe that people like you can make it, then it doesn't matter. You know, of course you're going to not engage in impulse control and deferred gratification. So America has to change too. This book is not about, hey, all these groups need to, you know, just fix it. It's really quite the opposite.
Alex writes, as an Asian American, I feel like my childhood sounds very much like what Amy Chua describes, but I believe the underlying cause of success is motivation, not background or culture. To put it so plainly as the three things they attribute to success is too simple and too convenient to Chua and Rubenfeld's background. What about the role of – can you distinguish? I guess what Alex is suggesting is that he was raised with a focus on motivation, but not necessarily something where he was made to feel either inferior or lacking in impulse control.
Well, we agree that motivation is the key. So to that extent, I completely agree with the listener's comment. But, you know, that's our whole book. How does motivation get instilled in kids? And that's the fascinating question. We believe that these three cultural traits or these three qualities are the backbone, the source of motivation, because, you know, I don't believe motivation is genetic, and I don't believe you can wave a magic wand at kids and motivate them. So the question is, how does motivation get created? That's the question that our book tries to answer.
Karen writes a critical email. I've heard Amy Chua espouse her parenting approach in the past, and I find these writings and approach to parenting to be both offensive and racist. In addition, she's managed to reinforce the stereotype of the Asian kid as an academic superstar, thereby potentially creating more pressure on modern adolescents.
Well, you know, people can disagree. I know that parenting is a very sensitive topic. I respectfully disagree. The whole point of our book is showing that there is a generational arc that is applicable to all immigrants, not just Asian Americans. So as we said, Asian Americans may outperform in the first or second generation, but by the third generation, they are no better at school than anybody else in America. So that shows that it's not innate to the culture. It's not something about Asians. It's really much more about the immigrant experience.
Your children are coming of age, right? College age. What do you want for them?
You know, that's a great question for me to answer by saying, you know, how do we define success? Because a lot of people have asked us that. And let me tell you very simply how we define success. Success means achieving your goals. That's what I think of as success, whatever those goals might be. Do we focus on material wealth in our book? Yes, of course we do. And why do we do it? Well, one, you can measure it. But two, because for a lot of people, especially underprivileged people, that is one of their goals and an important one. And it's worth finding out what we can about why some groups are doing disproportionately better than others, because we can all learn from it. But at the end of the day, our book is not about material success. There are many kinds of success. And we believe that the same package of qualities can empower people to achieve success as they define it. One of the great triumphs of America is that as kids grow up from whatever their cultural background might be, they turn around and they say, you know what? We don't want to do what our parents wanted us to do. We don't want to do what our society is telling us to do. We want to be an artist. We want to be a social activist. But if you can take some drive and grit and bring that to your own choices about success, to me, that might be the ideal.
Ang in Granite Bay is next. Ang, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I would like to piggyback on the last person saying that motivation, but at the same time, you mentioned something regarding grit. is the perseverance part of all this as well, and that, you know, we lose it as we get more acculturated and we get more into the social media and so forth, and we don't persevere as well.
Yeah, completely. We explore this. Actually, it's very interesting. We're in this society where there's so many distractions. I mean, I can't stop checking my email. I think this is something where we do take a position on. I think just instilling the ability to focus and sit still, and this has to be done at a very young age in kids, is probably something that we could all benefit from. And that is related to perseverance and resisting temptation.
Let's get one more call in. Jack, a quick call and question, if you would, please, in Burlingame.
Hi, I think that you'll find that students do better when either they or their parents come from a country where being a teacher is a much higher status than it is in the USA. And I really think everyone would benefit somehow, some way, over the next 20 years, we can manage to rise that status of teachers, you know, in the media, in our homes, across the board. And I think that in that case, kids are going to be more reverent in school, less likely to fool around, and it'll pay off.
Jack, thanks. Thanks for the call. Nice homage to teachers as we conclude our program. What's the one takeaway you most would like people to get from your book?
Well, for me, the takeaway is that the well-lived life cannot be measured by material income. What's important is for people to write the scripts of their own lives, to see their lives as something that extends over time, and to seize the reins of time. Now, in our culture right now, with immediate gratification, live in the moment, lots of people don't do that. The triple package, in a way, is all about being able to decide for yourself what you're committed to, what you want your life to look like, and to work toward that over time.
And you're okay if your kids are starving artists, Amy Char?
I absolutely, if they love it and really are committed to it, I am.
Amy Chua and Jed Robenfeld, they'll be at the Commonwealth Club today at noon, at Book Passage in Corte Madera tomorrow at 4. The book again, The Triple Package, How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America. Thanks both very much for being on our program today.
Thanks
for having us.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.